Case number 21-2732, Andre Reynolds et al. V. Brandon Sesniak et al. Oral arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Joel Barnett Sklar for the appellants.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name again is Joel Sklar for Andre Reynolds, for the personal representative in the estate of Deborah Reynolds. And I know the court has read these briefs and looked at these videotapes. This is a case that tests what are the pleading standards to bring a state-created danger doctrine case and a custodial exception case under DeShaney, and to bring a 14th Amendment equal protection claim. The facts of this case are pretty startling, I believe. Deborah Reynolds was at a 7-Eleven in Ferndale with two, engaged at the time with two white persons that were talking to her. There was a gentleman, D'Angelo Martin, who was behind her. The police apparently had a call of disturbance. They came out to the scene, and what they found was Ms. Reynolds speaking to those people in an active 7-Eleven. They went to make contact with her, discovered that she was drinking a 24-ounce Natty Ice and that she was drunk. She was so drunk that she could not follow instructions as to how to use a breathalyzer test despite repeated instructions from the officers. The officers issued her a citation for the open intoxicant, and this is when things begin to be very terrible for Ms. Reynolds.
Citation she gave to the gentleman, probably not the right word, but with the person she was with, who I think also maybe had his arm around her, they had their arms around each other.
Well, this is
they looked like they knew, you haven't mentioned this part of the story, but it appeared that they sort of knew each other fairly well, or at least a little bit.
They didn't know each other very well.
They did or didn't?
They did not.
Did it appear that way to the officers?
Let's see what, that's the issue, right? What did appear to the officers?
Well, let's
take a look at what appeared.
We can look at the video, right?
Correct.
You agree we can look at the video?
You can certainly look at the video, and the video has to be interpreted at this stage in the favor of the plaintiff, not in favor of the defendant. And you have to look at the entire video and the full context of the video. It is a line in the video where Ms. Reynolds tells the officers that she is not with Mr. Martin. She doesn't want to go with Mr. Martin. She does not want to go to Detroit. The officers know that she does not live in Detroit. They wrote her a citation that said she lives on Hoover Street in Warren, Michigan. Despite these wishes, despite her unwillingness to go with them, the officers took Ms. Reynolds, took Mr. Martin from a safe location in Ferndale, which has a far less crime rate. It has far more, had far more light. It's an active 7-Eleven to a curb on Woodward and State Fair in Detroit, where she, after that night, she's never found again. Her body is found in a house in Annan Street, just blocks from where the officers dropped her off with Mr. Martin. Mr. Martin was charged with five murders.
Is that enough to, under DeShaney, or under the way we've interpreted it, we've got the state-created danger kind of doctrine, right?
Correct.
And so you have to be kind of worse off after the police interaction.
Absolutely.
Than you were before, right?
100%.
Is it enough that they took me from some place that is, let's say, generally safer from like just a crime statistic point of view to some place that's not?
Oh, no, I don't think it's simply statistical. If my argument isn't simply based on the statistics of crime in one or the other, I think we have to look at what the police found at the time. At the time they found Ms. Reynolds, she is with two other people who appear to be concerned about her. People
a serial killer. Now, they don't know it, but when they drop her off, she's with the same person.
How
is she worse off?
Because they isolated her. When they found her in Ferndale.
They dropped her off a gas station where there were a couple people in front.
Well,
a couple people in front of the other gas station.
That's not really the case, Your Honor. She is directly next to a 7-Eleven. There are hold on.
We talk. I mean, just be polite, but we talk, and you. I'm just asking. I'm telling you how I see the case.
I got it.
Okay, so she's at a 7-Eleven, then she's at a Sunoco.
Correct.
It wasn't a dark. They didn't drop her off like in a dark alley or at a crack house.
They did not. They did not take her to her home that was simply a few blocks away either. What they did is they took her from a place where she was engaged with two people. We know that because we see it on the videotape. We certainly know that people are looking at her because they called the police, and the likelihood, and I think the court could infer, that that person was eyeballing Ms. Reynolds as well to see if the police had come to take care of her or deal with her. And then they remove her from that environment where there are eyes looking at her, where there are people
How do they know those are good eyes or bad eyes?
Well,
they know what's behind these eyes.
No, they know there are two people talking to her. That they do know. They do know that she's not alone with D'Angelo Barton.
That they do know. They do know that she's right next to the 7-Eleven that has surveillance. That they do know. And they take her to an environment that is completely different, to a place that she is unfamiliar with. When they found Ms. Reynolds, she was with her lawn chair next to the 7-Eleven. They took Ms. Reynolds, they take her to Sunoco in Detroit, where she knows nobody. They don't apprise anybody at the Sunoco of her presence or her attendance. They don't tell anybody at the Sunoco about Barton, D'Angelo Barton's attendance or presence. What they don't see, check to see if she has a phone. You can see the videos. She is clearly vulnerable, clearly helpless, and they have unalterably changed the environment from one place to another where all things are not equal. There is nothing equal about the Sunoco station leaving her at a curb with D'Angelo Martin, who she doesn't want to be with and who she told the police she wasn't with, from Hazel Park. Those are two different worlds.
I mean, she didn't. They had their arms around each other. He took the ticket. She didn't resist that. She didn't put up so much of a fight about being loud with. She was with him before. She was with him after. I don't think she made much objection to that. She did say she lives in Warren. I recognize that.
Yes, and she did tell the officer that she was going to sue her when she made her leave.
Yeah, that doesn't have anything to do with who she was with.
Well, it's the unwillingness of the transportation, obviously. She didn't want to go to Detroit. That's clear. She didn't want to go. I know the court is saying that she was familiar with Mr. Martin. That's what I'm hearing from you, Your Honor, that there was a photograph that you could look at. And at one point in time, they had their arm around her. I will put to you that the interpretation of the video has got to be fully contextual, where she says she is not with Martin and she doesn't want to go anyplace. And certainly the officers knew that she was vulnerable. They knew she couldn't make an independent decision. They knew that she was helpless. Their own policies, which sadly are not part of the record because I did get to have discovery, would mandate that they take her to the station or take her to a hospital. You don't release somebody or take somebody who was drunk, take them outside of the city to a place where they do not live, and leave them with somebody who's 34 younger than she is. They don't even know who he is. They ran his name through the lien system and the computer system.
Rule if officers always, every time you're in any violation of law, they have to take you to jail rather than letting you go. I bet a lot of defendants wouldn't like that rule that you're advocating.
Well, no, I'm not suggesting that's the rule. I'm suggesting that the policy is, and if I had discovery, I'm sure this is the policy, is that when you release you can't release an intoxicated person. That's the policy that the city has, is basically that you don't release somebody who's intoxicated out into the world because it's dangerous to do so.
But as a matter of kind of state-created danger law, we've had cases where cops have released intoxicated persons, right? They've taken them to another place.
Absolutely.
I mean, you can't put someone in a vehicle with a drunk driver, whatever that Steinway, whatever one of those cases, but there are very few cases where these cases have gone forward.
Your Honor, no question about it. The standard is exceptionally high.
Why is this one? I'm still trying to figure out. Is it just the difference between the 7-Eleven and the Sunoco?
No.
I understand that what eventually happened obviously is problematic, but they don't know that at the time. So
right.
What is it? What makes this like those cases?
I'll give the court an analogy that the Sixth Circuit has, I think, since 1998, the Davis versus Brady case. You know, in Davis, there was a gentleman who's picked up. He's drunk. He's involuntarily left someplace there, by the side of the road. And that gentleman walks into the street, gets killed. The court said that the state violated his 14th Amendment substantive due process rights when they took him, knowing that he was drunk, left him on the side of the road, knowing that there was a risk, a substantial risk, that he could cause himself harm, which he did. And in that case, the court found that the custodial exception applied. Even though the police had dropped him off and had gone, they were still responsible for his safety because they had taken him from an environment which was more safe.
She's driving to 7-Eleven as this nirvana, but she was there with a serial killer and she was drunk. And when they dropped her off, she was with a serial killer and she was drunk.
As were they both, correct. And I suppose that what I'm trying to emphasize is that the two worlds are not equal. Where she was in Ferndale with the serial killer who was drunk, she was not alone with the serial killer who was drunk.
First of all, it's troubling to me that you are implying that they knew that she was with a serial killer, and they did not know that.
I'm not making that implication in the least. My implication
is... It sounds like it. They dropped her. She was with a serial killer, and they took her with the serial killer and dropped her off with the serial killer. But what they did was, she was with a man who was younger than she, and they then took her someplace else and took him there too and dropped the two of them off there. But they did. There's nothing in this record to give them any knowledge either that he was a serial killer or what the specific risk that she was eventually apparently fell prey to, that they would have known what that risk was.
I agree. I'm not suggesting they knew he was a serial killer. What I'm suggesting is that the police officer's affirmative acts increased the risk of harm to Ms. Reynolds, greater than it was when she was with D'Angelo Martin in the city of Ferndale with the 7-Eleven, with people around her in a lighted, active area. And when
the people who were around her at the 7-Eleven left, is there some reason that Martin couldn't have done to her, if he in fact did do it to her, couldn't have done it to her at the 7-Eleven? Well, as opposed to at the Sunoco station?
What he could or could do, that I just don't know. But I would posit.
So why is the Sunoco station a greater danger then?
Because the police literally isolated her with Martin when they took her to the Sunoco station. And I'm going on the facts that we do know for certain. And what we do know for certain is that she was not alone at the 7-Eleven, that she was with other people, that it is a different environment completely. And to take someone who is inebriated, Ms. Reynolds, and put her in a place that she does not live, in a city that she is not familiar with, in an area that is notoriously awful, it's not out of it's foreseeable, quite frankly, that you have exposed her to a greater risk of harm, either from Martin or some other predator. This is exactly where Davis kind of comes in. You know, in Davis, this court found that there was a 14th Amendment due process violation, but they didn't know who the... But nobody knew what car was going to come in.
You might have a point that they may have exposed her to other dangers if it was this Detroit neighborhood is more dangerous than the Ferndale neighborhood. But again, she was with the serial killer in both places, and I'm not sure, vis-a-vis the threat that he posed, it changed much, if at all, between the two places.
Well, I think that for the pleading stage, I think under Lippman versus Budish, I made enough to get there. I think I do have a plausible claim. What the court may think, if factually, I think is really a question of fact for the jury. The issue is under Lippman, taking the allegations as they are true, do we make a plausible claim? I think we do. I think we do make that plausible claim. The standard that the court utilized and that this court should not utilize is a Rule 56 standard. This is a 12B motion.
Okay. Your time is run, but you'll have your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. Kelly Henderson on behalf of all of the Ferndale defendants. I think what is important to note, and I would, throughout the course of this, like to correct some of the misstatements that were just made, but what I think is important to focus on is all three elements of the state-created danger claim, which we don't believe plaintiff can satisfy any of those, starting with where the district court started.
About the factual recitation that your friend on the other side gave us, are there any facts that you think he misstated from the video that would be plain and obvious, or things he didn't include that are helpful to your call?
Well, I think our brief addressed this. There are several facts. Yes, there are several facts that I think are left unaddressed that we do see in the video, which are several of the references by Ms. Reynolds where she uses the conjunctive the we. She references both her and Mr. Martin together, that we just got here, we were talking. And then there's also the statements in regards to the individuals outside of the 7-Eleven. He continually references that they were looking out for her. This is an inference that I don't believe is supported at all by the videos and by the evidence that has been pled, which is that the officers were called to the scene because there were people complaining about individuals drinking outside of the 7-Eleven. That is what the officers knew, is that there were people in the city of Ferndale complaining about these two individuals. Why didn't they take her home, Your Honor? I do not know that. I believe yes, in Warren, which I believe council represented was a few blocks away. Warren is actually several miles away from where they were.
Several miles away. Why didn't they take her home?
Your Honor, I believe based on the video, they believed she was staying with Martin. They believed the two of them were staying together. That is what he told the officers, is that she was, I think she says he's his cousin, but that they are both staying together.
How did they pick me? I don't remember this from the video, but... I could be mistaken. How did they pick the
Sunoco's? The location?
Yes.
That and that's in the pleadings as well, that Officer Zyrowski, one of the officers there, was familiar with Martin. She had interactions with him previously, and so he had told her that he stays around there, and that's where she previously had taken him in one of her prior interactions, and so they just took him, they took both of them where they believed that he was staying under the impression that she was also staying with Martin at the time, and so that's why they chose that location. They believe.
Friend on the other side, I think, says in the briefs that Martin was obviously homeless. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, there's no indication that he was homeless. The officer's interactions were based on her prior interactions with him, that that's where he stayed around that area. I believe that's what's in the pleadings. And so that's why they took him to that area, believing that that's where he stayed, was in that area. And regardless...
You come up there, these two people, they're clearly intoxicated, can't even blow into the breathalyzer. So the solution is to take them to some other gas station in the city of Detroit and just drop them off when you know that she has an address? It just seems odd to me.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the district court recognized that while they're off, their actions may not have been the best course of actions. The question is whether plaintiff has stated a constitutional violation based on those actions, and that's what...
Yeah, no, the high bar helps you a lot, yeah.
Yes, Your
but,
Honor.
Are there any policies? What's going on with... I mean, is this what they're supposed to do,
Your Honor,
in the city of Ferndale?
Your Honor, we haven't addressed the question of policies in this case such that what my... Brother counsel was referring to, those policies have not been produced in this case.
But as he points out, we're on a 12B6 motion. We aren't at summary judgment.
He'd like to see those policies, actually.
Correct, Your Honor, and I'm sure he would. And there are mechanisms for him to
Can you make a public records request? Are they public records?
He could, Your Honor. He could be making those. But in order to get the discovery that we all recognize that he wants, he has to plead a sufficient constitutional violation here. And that is what he has failed to do.
Would it be a constitutional violation if the city had a policy that they always remove people from Ferndale to Detroit?
I don't believe that alone would be a sufficient constitutional violation, Your Honor, and that is not what we even have here. What we don't have is any facts. If we're going to address the Monell claim, there's no facts in regards to what the policies actually do say.
If they had a policy that said that, or if they had an informal practice that said if they find African Americans in Ferndale, that they remove them to Detroit?
That, Your Honor, might be more of a poor situation where we might have a constitutional question there. If it was we're going to take all African Americans and take them out of the city of Ferndale, that, yes, Your Honor, and that is certainly... I have never seen such a policy. I don't believe there's such an allegation there either. There's no facts to support that. What we are dealing with here is, in regards to the equal protection claim, if we're going to look at that, all plaintiff relies on right now is statistical differences in the racial makeup of the city of Ferndale and its police force in the city of Detroit. And when we look more specifically to the state-created danger doctrine and what's been implied there, that by moving Ms. Reynolds from the city of Ferndale to the city of Detroit, where the crime statistics are higher, plaintiff has alleged a general risk, which the state-created danger doctrine requires far more than that. It requires a specific risk to Ms. Reynolds, and that's why plaintiff relies on the fact that she was left with a serial killer. An alleged serial killer at this point, I'll give him that. But that is the specific danger he now alleges satisfies that state-created danger doctrine requirement. And that alone, there's nothing, as the court has already recognized, that gave the officers knowledge that...
I don't think he's alleging that. I mean, I think he's saying that the situation that she was left in was more dangerous, given the Sunoco is the Sunoco situation was more dangerous than the 7-Eleven. There were fewer people around. The lighting was bad. Whatever it is, I mean, I don't think anybody is saying that the cop should have known that this person was a serial killer, right? I mean, why isn't that right? Just on that terms, why is the Sunoco not more dangerous just given the circumstances?
Your Honor, first off, I would say the Sunoco does not vary factually that much more from the 7-Eleven. Number one, the Sunoco we know is on Woodward Avenue, which is where that's a highway, it's a high traffic area. To say that there's less traffic, I think, is a misnomer. But also, when we look at just the crime statistics, to say that Sunoco is more dangerous, I think that is an improper analogy. Those general statistics as to the entire city of Detroit, that is a general danger, not a specific danger that these officers should have known of. And what plaintiff has alleged here is that Mr. Martin was the danger. He was the harm that Ms. Reynolds suffered. And the officers here, to plead a sufficient state-created danger claim, the officers here would have had to be deliberately indifferent to the danger that Mr. Martin presented. Not that, you know, she might be robbed at the gas station.
Well, they could have dropped her off at home and him off at the Sunoco, right?
They're in separate cars.
I mean, they have an address for her.
They could have, Your Honor. There's lots of different things they could have done, but whether what they did do is a constitutional violation is really what we're presented with here. And on the flip side of that, if we want to even go down that road, she was left with an individual who seemed at least as coherent, younger, more in control of his faculties, perhaps, than her, to take care of her, such that what they did, there might be a flip side to what they did do, leaving her in the care of someone else that could aid her, who lived nearby. But again, those are not what is required to meet the constitutional violation that plaintiff has pled. And here I simply just do not see where there are enough there's a factual premise to support this claim here. And I do want to address the Davis case that plaintiff's counsel referenced, because I believe there's some confusion in what he's referencing there, where in the Davis case, an individual was killed while walking down the side of the road where officers left him on the side of the road. There is another case, Cartwright, which we cited in our brief, which is where the officers transported an individual and left from the side of the road and left him at a gas station. That is where, in Cartwright, the court said there was no violation because he was presumably left in a safer position. And the district court rejected plaintiff's analogy to the Davis case, where officers left him on the side of the road and he was harmed, because of the nexus of the harm there, which the district court here also said was just lacking. There was no nexus.
I remember a case I had where the victim was left at a McDonald's, I think it was. So if the police basically drop you off at a public location, not the side of the road, not a dark road, whatever it is, per se, is that okay, basically?
I think that would be factually dependent, Your Honor, on the circumstances.
Well,
but
wouldn't
here,
it be clearly established if it were a qualified immunity situation?
Perhaps I'm not understanding the question.
I'm just saying, if given the state of the law right now, if the police drop you off at a public location, a restaurant, a gas station, not on the side of the road, okay, and then something happens, but there's nothing that would put them on notice that would be problematic. I'm just saying, is that essentially where we are with kind of the there are a lot of cases that involve this similar scenario, more than I would have ever thought, but it happens. You drop, the police pick somebody up, they drop them off. What I'm just saying, are there any cases where they have dropped somebody off in kind of a public location, a similar location to this, something bad happens and there's liability? Or is it essentially the case that as long as you're not dropping somebody off in a isolated dark, road or whatever it is, you're okay?
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe you've correctly surmised that is the current state of the law in what has been clearly established, and I think Cartwright is a good example of that, where they did leave him in a convenience store parking lot, and that was not found to be a violation, such that right now, as the law stands, there has to be some facts that give these officers
knowledge.
But, I mean,
we do have these other cases. We have Lippman versus Spudish. We have the drunk driver case. I mean, there are other scenarios, I guess, where we've recognized liability, though, right? Or the possibility of liability.
Correct. There are some where we've recognized the possibility of liability, where there is a sufficiently close nexus between the harm that is ultimately suffered, that the and their officers had some facts that would have given them knowledge of the risk that was being posed at that time, such that that's where that dividing line in the case law is right now, and that's what the district court also held, is that there's that dividing line of deliberate indifference, of the knowledge requirement of what risk the officers have to have knowledge of, and that's what we didn't have here. Any knowledge of the risk that was ultimately succumbed to Ms. Reynolds, which was that of Mr. Martin.
We still don't know, do we, whether Mr. Martin is the one
That is correct, Your Honor. But even at this stage, were we to accept plaintiff's allegation that Mr. Martin was the one that killed Ms. Reynolds, there's still no facts, as the district court recognized, as to how, when, or any of this occurred. There was at 14 months between when this happened and when Ms. Reynolds' body was discovered, such that we don't even know when she befell this harm from Mr. Martin.
Okay. Anything else?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you. Your Honors, the Cartwright case, the linchpin of that was that the plaintiff in the case, plaintiff's decedent, I suppose I should say, there was no restraint on liberty. The officers had offered to continue to drive him wherever he wanted to go, but they had to stop to pick up somebody else. They said they would have to frisk him, and he said, "Don't frisk me, I'm getting out of the car." His liberty was never restrained, and that was the linchpin of the rationale. In our case, my client did not want to go to Detroit, didn't want to get in a car, didn't want to leave. Her liberty was restrained, which is why Davis is more apt.
So you're saying this is a custodial, you're saying it's a custodial case and a...
Yes.
State, I don't know if they're both considered state, whatever. You know,
state credit, right. I'm certain that she hits both criteria.
But so what is the evidence that she was, basically she was being restrained against her will?
Well, she did not want to get in the car with Zarowski. She did not want to leave Ferndale. And she told Zarowski when she ordered her to get in the car, she didn't want to go anyplace, that she was going to sue the fuck out of her.
But she didn't suffer any harm while she was in their custody, did she?
Well, the strain on her liberty post giving her the citation may be a constitutional harm, but no, I think
I'm just saying, just as a technical matter, the way I understand the custodial cases, I thought that was just involved actual custodial injury.
The court is absolutely correct. However, it doesn't end upon once the person is released. That's what Davis tells us. That's what
end at some point, doesn't it? I mean,
no, it certainly does.
So, and we don't even know. She was murdered. We don't know when, how long after. She didn't step out of the car and get hit by a car on the side of the road.
It's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Why don't you just? I mean, if I was you, I'd just go with the state created danger case. I'm not saying that's a winning case, but it seems better. To me, my perspective, that seems better for you.
Well, I think under Lippman versus Budish, I would agree with you. And I think Lippman versus Budish also makes that distinction that the custodial exception wasn't so great, but the state-created danger doctrine could survive.
What about the argument, though, that Lippman, yes, Lippman, and there's some other cases that may be helpful, but we do have this kind of branch of cases that involve police dropping people off in areas.
Right.
And I don't know... What is the case where they drop somebody off at a public, at a restaurant, gas station, whatever, where there's liability?
There is a district court case. I think it's Delray County, which is a Michigan case. I apologize.
I'm just struggling with these. Most of these cases where I understand if they drop you off in what is an obvious kind of dangerous, dark location where the injury that results then is something that you could have foreseen,
right?
Like getting hit by a car. Right. Here, it's a public place, and the injury is getting murdered.
Well,
I'm not sure that it matches up, at least for immunity purposes.
Well, I disagree with. I think here that when you have to look at the case facts specifically. I think the facts of this case are somewhat unique because you have not just the affirmative acts, but you do have someone who you know is completely vulnerable and incapable of responding to simple commands,
That was true when she was at the 7-Eleven.
Well, I understand that, but then you take her away and leave her alone and isolate her. We differ on
Vanian's point. Is usually the injury is causally related to the surrounding circumstance because that's a dangerous area, and crime from that area harms the person or a car harms the person. Here it's the person they are with before and after.
Correct, but the environment changes everything, and that's kind of our position. Finally, Your Honor, I know
there wouldn't be any problem here if the police had seen what was going on at the 7-Eleven and had just left her there with Martin, and then he killed her. No responsibility.
There'd be no claim. There'd be no affirmative act.
They took them to Bloomfield Hills. That'd have been okay.
If they would have taken Mr. Martin to Bloomfield Hills.
No, both of Bloomfield Hills.
If they took them to Bloomfield Hills motivated by the race, it would be wrong.
I'm talking about the race.
If they took in Bloomfield Hills, and it's a safer community, I doubt she'd be dead today. The reason they did take them to Detroit was because they were both black. My client did live there. They knew Martin was homeless because Zurowski says that in part of the tape. She had taken them to Quinder before. They didn't take them to home. They took them to a city that houses mostly black people. That's what Ms. Reynolds was. That's what Mr. Martin was. And that's why they were there. And that is a constitutional violation. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Case will be submitted. And I think that's the end of the calendar. Okay. We can adjourn.
This honorable court is now adjourned.